chapter 5, and we will continue our journey through the themes, through five major themes of this book. Just to set the stage, chapter 4 is actually a vision of one who is sitting on the throne. And this is all part of the same vision, but we're going to pick up in chapter 5, following that chapter where the one sitting on the throne is worshipped and given praise and glory and honor. And we pick up in chapter 5, verse 1. Then a scroll in the right hand of the one who is sitting on the throne. Then I saw a scroll in the right hand of the one who was sitting on the throne. There was writing on the inside and the outside of the scroll, and it was sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel who shouted with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals on this scroll and open it?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll and read it. And then I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll and to read it. But one of the 24 elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the heir to David's throne, has won the victory. He is worthy to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb that looked as if it had been slaughtered, but it was now standing between the throne and the four living beings. And among the 24 elders, he had seven horns and seven eyes, which represent the sevenfold spirit of God that is sent out into every part of the earth. He stepped forward and he took the scroll from the right hand of the one sitting on the throne. And when he took the scroll, the four living beings and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they held gold bowls filled with incense, which are now the prayers of God's people. And they sang a new song with these words: "You are worthy to take the scroll and to break its seals and open it, for you were slaughtered, and your blood has ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have caused them to become a kingdom of priests for our God, and they will reign on the earth." And I looked again, and I heard the voices of thousands and millions of angels around the throne and of the living beings and the elders, and they sang in a mighty chorus, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slaughtered to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing." And then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea, they sang, "Blessing and honor and glory and power belong to the one sitting on the throne and to the Lamb forever and ever." And the four living beings said amen. And the 24 elders fell down and worshiped the Lamb. This is the word of the Lord. Amen. So this is week 2 of our attempt to frame the book of Revelation thematically. Big picture themes that run through the whole book. And last week we tried to frame the story of Revelation in terms of the arcing story of the entire Bible, beginning with God is creator, which orients us from the beginning. We are creature. We are the created. And the story continues. What God made, God called good, and God has continued to be faithful to his creation. And in spite of his creation's rebellion from him, he has entered into his creation in such a way as to set in motion its complete restoration, resurrection even, so that all that dies, and all dies, all will die, all that dies will be raised to new life, being called new creation. This is the promise of our sacred scriptures. And when we consider our lives, our own lives, our own place within this cosmic story of creation and new creation, we discover that there is a place for us. There's a place for ourselves in this story. But this story also reorients us in such a way that we're forced to face that sort of painful reality that David McCullough reminded us of in that graduation speech. You are not the center of the universe. And we're reoriented by this story in that way. We are not the center. In fact, biblically, it seems as if the inability to distinguish between creator and created is really at the heart of creation's disorder, what the Bible calls idolatry or sin and rebellion. Is a misorientation of the created to the creator. One of the things that Revelation, when we read it and listen to it and let it have its way in us, one of the things it does to us is it gives us a tremendous vision of new creation, of what God is doing. But it does more than that, because right up front, in the very beginning, in chapter 4, which, like I said, we didn't read that today, but in chapter 4, we're given a vision of the one who is honored and praised and who receives all of the glory for creating and recreating all things. It's not just about what's being done. Our story is not just about where it's going and what's going to happen to us when we die or whatever, but it is primarily about the one who is doing it. Revelation reminds us, it gives us a big vision of the one who sits on the throne. Chapter 4 gives us that vision, and it's a big vision. God on his throne. Worshipped rightly by all of creation is what the picture gives us. And this is a good scene. All is right, at least in this heavenly scene. All is as it should be. And that's the truth. As long as the orientation of our lives, the orientation of our world is centered rightly around the one on the throne, all is as it should be. But when our orientation is on anything or anyone other than that central who, then we are in a place of disorder. Our lives are in disorder, rebellion. And the scriptures say that our lives in rebellion lead only to destruction. And so Revelation 4 functions as an orientation for us as we enter that book. Anything that happens in the rest of Revelation, it must be remembered that no matter what visions you see, no matter what promises are made, no matter what sort of atrocities you see and you witness, it's important to keep in mind that there is one who is faithful and trustworthy, who's sitting on the throne, and this one deserves all of our honor and all of our praise and all of our glory and all of our lives. But if you're familiar with any of the rest of the Bible, pretty much, you realize that this isn't just a message that Revelation gives to us. You know, this vision of God on a throne and creatures rightly worshiping him, it's not from Revelation. In fact, we find this vision in lots of other places in our scriptures. It's not just from here. In Isaiah 6, we get this picture of the heavenly throne room and God sitting on his throne, and he is worshiped by these heavenly beings. And in fact, God's glory is so expansive, so radiant that it actually bursts out of the heavenly throne room and into and all throughout all of creation. Ezekiel 1 also helps us to imagine this throne where God sits on it and he's rightly worshiped. And if you read the Ezekiel passage, you'll find there's all kinds of really interesting God-honoring shenanigans kind of going on in that picture. And it's wild and it's kind of fun. Daniel 7, right? I mean, on and on, we get the point. There's a throne and God sits on it and he's worshiped when all is right. These scenes were so, so important for the ancient Jewish people. These were their stories. And these images, they told a certain kind of story. about who they were, about who God was, about what it meant for them to be a small, insignificant people in the world. See, because the Hebrew people, they weren't actually the only ancient people around. And in fact, they weren't the only ancient people to tell stories and to tell stories of a God who sits on a throne and who gets worshipped and who rules. In fact, it seems as if almost everybody around during that day had a story to tell, all kinds of stories, and some of them are pretty interesting stories. They had quite the imagination. Not only did they, and they didn't just settle for one God like the Jewish people, they thought, why have one? We could have two. We could have five. We could have gods of gods, gods upon gods of gods of gods, and you find there are lots of stories of all kinds of interesting divine figures who demanded worship and who might show you favor if you worship them correctly. Maybe you think when you hear about gods and gods and gods and multiple of them, that's kind of a weird thing. But it was actually these prophetic visions. It was the Jewish people's claim that there was one God that was viewed as weird or bizarre in the ancient world. These prophetic visions of the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, sitting on a throne, these were just bizarre. You only have one God? The biblical scenes that we read that orient us to a God who sits on a throne, they're filled with creatures, people, living heavenly creatures, all kinds of created beings oriented around and worshiping God. And the Jewish story was a weird story because that God was one. That God declared, demanded ultimate allegiance and said, I am one. There is no other besides me. And you might not think that this is the weird claim. You know, one God, that kind of makes sense to us. In fact, you know, in our culture, we probably just think this is normal. The question in our culture today isn't, you know, hey, how many gods do you believe in? The question, that's not the question. The question is, do you believe in God? The assumption is that there's one or none. You know, and so it was a really bizarre thing for this group of sort of wandering nomadic people to be wandering around what we kind of know as the Middle East today, just declaring, there's one God, there's one God. But that's what they were doing. And they were perceived as quite strange. I want to suggest this morning, as we consider Revelation 5 and what we're doing in Revelation and what we're going to hear and what we even have sung this morning, as we have sung songs to Jesus, I want to suggest the Jewish commitment to a radical monotheism, the Jewish commitment to one God, was so strong that we should hear the words of Revelation 5 as being quite strange, coming from the pen of an ancient Jew in the first century. Think back to last week with me real quick. When I described the way that many Christians read the Old Testament prophets. So remember last week what I said about the way that we tend to read is that we tend to go back to the prophets and we tend to look at them through the theme of predictions about Jesus, future predictions about Jesus. And there's no doubt that exists there. We can go back and we can find verses that talk about, that anticipate Jesus. And the apostles in the Gospels and Paul, they point back and they say, yes, indeed, the scriptures did talk about Jesus. And so that exists. But we quickly discover, like I said last week, that if that's the main theme we have to read those prophets, there's going to be little else that makes sense to us because most of the material doesn't make sense through the theme of future predictions about Jesus. But it turns out we actually end up getting stuck in a cycle. It's kind of a brutal cycle when we try to read the prophets in this way. When this is sort of our only way of reading them, is that these prophets must be talking about Jesus and Jesus coming at a later date. Because we start to say things like this. I just don't understand how the Jewish people could not have seen Jesus as the Messiah. How could they miss it? It was so obvious. You know, and what we do is we take this verse here and this verse here and this verse here and this verse here that all do point to Jesus, and we kind of pull them all together and say, it's so obvious to us. If we add them up, they spell out Jesus the Messiah, who is God and who must be trusted in for salvation. That's kind of our story. That's what we say. And it's one way of telling the Jesus story out of the prophets. But what if that way of reading the prophets is slightly inadequate, especially when it comes to understanding the Old Testament as a book, when it comes to understanding the Old Testament's influence on the New Testament, and specifically the book of Revelation? What if we need to find a new theme? Because it's kind of like this. If we walked out of the movie, The Dark Knight, and I was going on and on about, you know, the Batman movie, the second one with Heath Ledger. He's the crazy, you know, really, really good Joker. I mean, that movie has some deep themes, some good stuff to talk about. If we walked out of there and all I could talk about was, man, Batman's gadgets were so cool. Did you see his car? It was like the sweetest car I'd ever seen for Batman. If that's what I was really interested in, and that's as deep as I could go talking, you would stare at me like, really, that's what you got from that movie? I mean, there's such good stuff there. You'd be wondering, did you even watch the movie at all? I had clearly missed one of the major, major themes of the movie, if that's all I could walk out talking about. Certainly, the gadgets and the cars are fun and they're cool, but they're just a part of what's going on. And I think that there are more fruitful ways to watch that movie, and there are more fruitful ways for us sometimes to read the prophets. And I think when we think about the people who would have been reading the prophets in the first place, it's important for us to say, what would they have been hearing here? What would have been going on? How would God have been stirring in them and using these scriptures to shape them? And I want to suggest that there is a pretty significant theme working through the prophets, and that is the people's faithfulness or their faithlessness toward Israel's core conviction. Israel had a core conviction. They said it every morning as they woke up. Listen, Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Every morning they would say that. They would be reminded, this is who we are. We are defined by our faith in one God. There is only one God. This is what defines the Jewish people, not only in the ancient world, but all through history. I mean, we could look at them and we could say, yeah, they have laws and they practice circumcision, and they were weird because they observed Sabbath at a day when nobody took rest. I mean, but these were markers of them. But all of these markers, they pointed to their one God. When you looked at their lives, the things that they did, their behaviors, the orientation of their lives, everything said, these are people of one God. This is who they are. This is who they are. This is what they're about. The Jewish people were convinced that they had been called by this one God. They were convinced by this. They were convinced that they had actually had meaningful interactions with God, where God sort of shows up in their lives in meaningful ways, and they believed in the midst of cultures that believed in a pantheon, a plethora of gods, that there was only one creator, one Lord of all. This is important. Because I think we find the prophets, first of all, a more fruitful read if we can read them through that sort of theme. What's happening in the prophets is God, the one God, is calling somebody. He's calling somebody, a prophet, and he's anointing them with his power. And he's saying, you have a message, and that message is for the people. They have wandered from me, and you need to call them back to the one God. That's essentially the heart of what's going on in the prophets. And I think, You might discover if you jump in there that's a pretty helpful way of engaging the prophets. But more than that, because Revelation is so dependent on the prophets, I wonder if that theme of a call back to the one God might have something for us in our reading of Revelation. God alone is creator. But it turns out, and as we read this morning, that's not the only part of the Jewish story. It's not the only central part. See, the Jewish people, they weren't expected. I don't know if sometimes you feel like you're just expected to believe, like, on blind faith that, you know, yeah, all of this is legit, all of this is real. But the Jewish people weren't supposed to maintain their radical monotheism, their commitment to one God, just based on a hunch. That all these other people are saying, we believe in our gods, but we hope that our God is the right one. You know, I mean, that's not what was expected of them. This God actually enters into their lives, the lives of a small and insignificant group of people, in a profound way. And when God enters into the lives of people in such a profound way, everything changes. God doesn't just stay distant and send messages via, you know, heavenly creatures and angels and messengers. He does some of that, but God enters in a profound way. God, as we heard bits and pieces of the story this morning, God heard the cries of the people, of these people. And he comes down and he enters into their lives and he enters into their history in such a way that this moment radically transforms who they are as a people, how they understand themselves and what they understand their future existence to be. This series of events that we find in Exodus would forever shape their understanding of who they were and who this God was, who claimed to be unrivaled in the heavenly places. God alone was creator, they would confess. This is core to the Jewish conviction. God alone is creator, we confess. But God alone is redeemer. God alone was their redeemer. God made them. But God also came near. He rescued them from their oppression. But then, as we heard the story this morning, he draws them around himself in the desert. And he speaks to them. He offers them words. He offers them guidance. He offers them an invitation to be his people. Be my people, he says. And having rescued them, he then describes for them, what does it mean to be the people of God? I mean, honestly, like, what does it mean to be in unbroken friendship with a holy, loving, powerful God? How do you even do such a thing? But God gives them instructions on exactly what that looks like for them. And they say, we're in. We're all in. We want that. Where do we sign up? Read your Old Testament with redemption as the theme. With God's saving of Israel from Egypt, and the Old Testament will come alive in new ways. You will hear the ways that this story of redemption has sort of drenched every part of who they are. Every one of their texts has something to do, goes back in some way to this story where they understand their identity as a people who have been redeemed by God. It's core for us to understand this Jewish conviction if we're going to move forward in Revelation, because there will be sections of Revelation that will honestly get us bogged down. They feel kind of swampy with how difficult they can be to sort of wade through. But if we can remember that Revelation is the continuation of a story, The continuation of the story of a God, of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God, the one God who hears the cries of people, of the oppressed, and the one God who acts definitively on behalf of the people that he seeks to redeem. If we can keep that in mind, that will give shape to our understanding of the rest of this book, because the God who creates all things is the one who is worshipped and receives proper honor and glory in chapter 4. But this same God is the God who redeems. And this God is worshipped and receives proper glory and honor in chapter 5. The God who creates is the God who redeems. This is essential to keep connected. And this is what the Jewish people said for over 1,000 years before this text was written. But what does Revelation say about the continuation of this story? We spent a ton of time this morning talking about, and maybe you're thinking, what in the world is Kirst talking about? We've spent a ridiculous amount of time talking about God as one, monotheism. Yeah, there is one God. We believe that. That seems so obvious to us. But I've done so this morning. I've talked about this because I guess it's my hope that maybe chapter 5 we might be able to hear with new ears, hearing it from the perspective of an ancient first century Jew who might be hearing it for the first time. Our attentiveness to this radical monotheism of the Jewish people, it should immediately strike us the moment we jump into chapter 5. We should hear the continuity with the Exodus story, but at the same time, we should begin to hear the discontinuity, discord, tension. Something new is going on here. Something doesn't sound quite right. We should be struck as we get into the text in verse 3 that there is a scroll. There is a scroll that no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth is worthy to open. No one? No one in heaven or on earth or under the earth is worthy to open this? Not even the one who we just heard about who's sitting on the throne? What's going on here? The one that's declared to be worthy of all glory and power and honor and for having created all things. This one isn't worthy? Is that what chapter 5 is saying? And then in verse 5, we hear these powerful Old Testament messianic terms. The lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, or the root of Jesse. We discover that there is actually, in fact, one who can open the scroll. It's announced there is one, and it's the one who is victorious. But again, this is odd. It's not the one who's sitting on the throne. Rather, it's the one who stands in front of the throne. The one who's described as a lamb who looks as if he's been slaughtered. This is the one that's worthy. But, I mean, this should sound familiar to what we just read this morning. God used a slaughtered lamb. Actually, he used lots of slaughtered lambs as the means of release for the Israelites from Egypt. But, right, it's awkward then to say these lambs didn't achieve victory over the Egyptians. That doesn't seem quite right. The lambs, they simply kind of protected the Israelites. As they put the blood of it over their doorhouses, then the angel of the Lord passed over. So what's going on here? The Exodus story is actually a story about God's victory through slaughtering. But then here in chapter 5, the one depicted as being worthy said that he is worthy not because he slaughtered, but he's found worthy precisely because he refused to pick up a sword, being slaughtered himself for the people. And it gets weirder as we keep going, especially if you have a commitment to radical monotheism. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. It just doesn't really connect with what happens in verse 8. This is where it starts to get really awkward, actually. Verse 8, we have the same living creatures, the four living creatures described in chapter 4, and the 24 elders who we get a sense that they're human figures. These are created beings. They were worshiping the one who was sitting on the throne rightly in chapter 4. They have fallen before the Lamb. They lay before the Lamb in worship. To grasp a sense of how different the figures in chapters 4 and 5 are, chapter 4 essentially has avoided describing God with any terms that might be connected with the created order. It's all really vague. The one who sits on the throne does this. The one, it's all, there's a being there. He's at work, but we don't want to talk about him in any terms that might be construed as being one who's created. But then chapter 5, it seems like goes out of its way to say, no, the one who's being worshipped is crazy created. I mean, everything about him is created. He's described in creaturely terms. He's a lamb. And in fact, his destiny was the same destiny as all of the created order, which is death. The one being worshipped in chapter 5 has died. If you were Jewish and living in the first century, and if you had not yet followed Jesus as Messiah, this is blasphemy. There's no other word for it. This is blasphemy. But it's these kinds of claims and actions by early Christians that continued in the first century. And it's these kinds of actions and claims that made it harder and harder for Jewish followers of Jesus as Messiah to remain in fellowship with Jews who couldn't quite go there, who rejected Jesus. Typically because it sounded and it looked a lot like blasphemy. Essentially, to claim that God is both creator and redeemer, as the Jewish people always had, and to accept the claims of Jesus himself and to worship him as the earliest as his earliest followers had, you had to somehow be willing to make a jump to accept that God had done something fundamentally new, that somehow a God who is completely other than the creation, who would be described in terms as the one sitting on the throne, could then be so identified with the created order that this God might even take on the most ultimate of our ends, which is death. Something new has happened. And it would take the church a while to really develop the language to flesh out what this tension really means and how do we maintain this strict monotheism. There is only one God who is creator and redeemer, but yet somehow recognize that the fullness of God was present in this one named Jesus and that he deserved our full worship. And so ever since Jesus walked and offered himself fully to even to death and then was raised from the dead, there have been people falling at the feet of Jesus. And we have to somehow make sense of that. Because he receives what only God is to receive. Our lives, our worship, everything we have. And this is what the creatures and the elders are doing in this scene. They're worshiping the Lamb. And they are declaring that the Lamb is in fact worthy of everything we have. And that this Lamb is somehow, and Revelation I think makes the case, this Lamb somehow is in essence the same one that's worshipped in chapter 4. And it continues because there's singing that happens, and in Revelation singing means worship, and the songs are going right to Jesus, and so the Lamb and And again, it's identified as a new song, and so we're reminded again something new has happened. Chapter 5 is a great reminder of what we talked about last week, that God has begun something new. Revelation wants to claim that the God who redeemed Israel in Exodus is the God who has now performed a new Exodus, an Exodus for all of creation, setting free every living creature, the heavens and the earth, free, so that God might make them new, so that God might resurrect them to new life. That's the story of Revelation. We talked about last week the story from creation and new creation. There's also a new Exodus happening. Redemption. In Exodus, it's a pattern that's now happened again in a radically new way with a radically different result. Redemption to the Jewish people, again, was God's not remaining distant, but God's coming near and entering into their lives in such a profound way that everything had to change. But ultimately, it was their being set free from slavery under Pharaoh. And then redemption for the saints. And I think you'll discover as we read Revelation together that where you see the saints, you can fill in yourself in there. You can fill in our church. You can fill in the people of God. Redemption for the saints. We're made up of every tribe, every tongue, every nation, every people. Redemption is God's refusal to stay distant. And when we think about what happened in Exodus, to come even closer than God came in Exodus, but to somehow inhabit our humanity in such a way that he could be called a lamb and he could be slaughtered on our behalf and that we might be set free from our sins and from this world. Redemption is a new vision of a new Exodus. It's about Jesus setting people free to become fully human. The new Exodus is about Jesus setting the earth free to be resurrected, new creation, so that God might dwell fully and finally with his people. I hope as we sort of unpack these themes together, they give us a way of thinking about, as we get into some of the visions and some of the exciting stuff that happens later on, a way of imagining what God is doing in the midst of them. One of the ways to read Revelation is through the theme of new creation, and one of them is redemption, the new Exodus. And Revelation, it doesn't really help us in terms of giving us and nailing down precise terms what redemption means in its fullness, but here in chapter 5, we get at least a couple things as well as a couple places where it kind of pops up, but it's clear, and this is important, that Jesus is in fact the agent of this work in our lives and like I said before, is worthy of our praise and our honor. He is the Redeemer and is worthy of our lives. In chapter 1, we're told that this redemption was given to us by Jesus' blood and as an act of love. And so redemption is God's way of entering into our lives in love to rescue us. And we're also told that Jesus' death then has set us free from sin. Here in chapter 5, we're told that we've been set free from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. And then in chapter 14, we're told that we've been redeemed from the earth and again from all of humanity. So it's important for us as we consider what it means to be redeemed, The scope isn't just one group of people rescued from one nation. The scope is all people rescued from all oppressive powers. Revelation is about Jesus, and it's about Jesus enacting a new exodus throughout all of creation. As a theme of the book, we're invited to read and to listen with an attentive ear, asking how these visions might help us imagine. What does it mean to live as people who are called free? What does it mean to really imagine freedom in this world? What does it mean to imagine the ways that there are powers that we can't even see that continue to try to enslave us? What does it mean to imagine victory through death? What does it mean to imagine ourselves made fully alive? I've used this phrase twice now, thinking about it. To be made fully alive, to be made fully human. And in the first Exodus and in the new Exodus, we discover God has redeemed people for a purpose. Jesus is making us a kingdom and priests to our God. And we're going to get to flesh that out a little bit more. But maybe ask yourself, what does this mean? What does it mean for us to live out this redemption story? What does it mean to live as free people, fully alive in God, restored to God's intention for our humanity? Do we have eyes to see today the ways that God is actively setting his creation free around us and restoring it to its intended purposes? Just as there was a day when the Jewish people in the world were considered weird for believing in only one God, to call Jesus our Redeemer today is a weird claim in our world. We may not have lots of gods in the forms of sort of precious statues, but we certainly have a lot of pseudo-redeemers running around promising to set us free from our slavery, from our sins. Our culture tells us stories of redemption and invites us into them. But might we have ears to hear the story of redemption that's rooted in the one God, our one Redeemer? And we gather this morning on a Sunday, Resurrection Day, to be reminded and to confess together that there is only one God, one Creator, one Redeemer. Revelation will plead with us to let the invitation of redemption and true freedom to take hold of our lives, but not just once, over and over again. Would you pray with me? Father, would you help us to worship you, to give you our lives the way that we have read it, heard it, envisioned in chapter 5 of Revelation, Lord. This scene where the Lamb receives everything, all power and honor and glory and might. God, may we give that. May we offer that. May our lives be completely oriented to you, and may our lives be marked by the story of your redeeming work in our lives and in this world. We love you, and we trust you, and we thank you for your Son. Amen.